Okay. So nice to see you all. August is always a funny month for these calls because of summer and the Northern Hemisphere. So yeah, just delighted to see so many of you here. And yeah, really excited to talk more about the protector and the concept of the protector. So this is module six. This is our second module six call. Last week we talked about the protectors, like naming them, kind of starting to recognize them. You'll become very familiar with these protective patterns, and we'll continue to talk about these as we move through the program. I've got a couple of slides today. So in today's talk call, we're going to just revisit the kind of aims of this module. And we're going to move into how do you actually coach with these protectors? Like, what do we do with clients now that we might know more about how they are showing up, what's going on for them, you know, how these patterns are kind of manifesting in their lives. So we're going to be talking a bit about that, and we'll also give some suggestions for what you can take into practice pods, what you can play with yourself, and maybe even experiment with clients. Okay, so please feel free to add comments, feedback, suggestions, questions to the chat as we go through. This will be quite an interactive session. Okay, so I just want to revisit this concept of the protector. This is how we are characterizing self-doubt. Right, that it is a self-protection mechanism. And we see it in beliefs, in behaviors, in patterns. Right. And so I'm always kind of on the lookout for this in clients. When clients kind of declare themselves to be a specific kind of person, or they share a behavior that they feel some discomfort or shame around, something they want to change, or they report, oh, I always do this. Right, and you start to hear those kind of absolutist terms. This is a good indication that there's something to do with their protector that's at work, and it's worth investigating. Right, so we're going to talk today about how to use this model to intervene with a client to help them actually shift and change this pattern, expand their sense of what's possible for them. And how to do this in specific ways. Okay. So, just to revisit this protector and the whole purpose of our protector is to keep us safe from perceived risks. So, our protector is always basing its fears of risk on past experience. This has happened before, so this is what I've got to do to keep us safe. Right. For our protector, when we hold ourselves back, they can feel safe. This is a success. Now you're eating Doritos on the couch rather than being visible in your business. I can relax. I can chill. This feels way better. Right? I was anxious before. Now I'm cool. Now we're cool. Stay here, do this. Right? Of course, what also happens is that it doesn't just hold us back from risk, it holds us back from life. If our protector's behind the wheel, we're not doing much. So, what our clients will report is this frustration with themselves, the sense that they are self-sabotaging, that they are getting in their own way, that they can't do the things that they want to do, and there must be something wrong with them. And as self-belief coaches, we know what's actually happening is they're doing a really bloody great job of keeping themselves safe from some kind of perceived risk. And our job is to help them understand that, make sense of it, and do something different so that they can have a different result. Because they already know what happens when they're eating Doritos on the couch, right? We already know that. So it's like there's no urgency to change that. But if they want to, there are some safe ways that they can play with new ways of being, new ways of doing. And that's going to give them a path to creating the life that they want, the one that they can feel proud of. that has a lot of joy and meaning for them in. And then they'll be like, oh my God, you've got to call my coach, she's amazing. And you'll get repeat custom. And so everyone's happy.
Yeah.
So we've got these four patterns of protection. They're heavily correlated to our stress response, to that sense of the part of us that is always on the lookout for risk, always on the lookout for threat. And we're just going to revisit these and familiarize ourselves with them as we talk about how to intervene with each of them. Yeah. The thing to really know and take away from this session is that we can't change the protector with the same energy that created it. Right. What I mean by that is, if someone has an inner critic that is in charge of things, we can't change that inner critic by criticizing it. The inner critic's belief is all about perfectionism, right? I've got to do this right, or otherwise something bad's going to happen. So we can't give them more things to do right to change that. We've got to intervene in a different way. And the same is true for all of the protectors. So the way we do this, and the kind of realization I had, actually Scott pointed it out to me, and I was like, oh my God, this is miraculous. I didn't even plan for this, is that we've got to move around the model, right? So this is the self-belief coaching model. And to treat a critic, we need to move to self-acceptance. We need to use the resources of that self-acceptance aspect of the healthy adult self. To treat the martyr, we need to move to self-worth and utilize those resources, and that they're listed here. So for a martyr, we want to embrace boundaries, advocacy in action, and the space that a person takes up, right? Because the martyr is all about, I'm overgiving, right? The scapegoat, all about not trying. So we've got to move to self-trust, using their intellect and intuition, taking a perspective, making decisions. And for someone with a bystander pattern, moving to self-belief. What's your vision and goals? Why do the thing? What are you waiting for? Right? Leadership and encouragement. How do we lead our lives out of that place of, wait, just keep overthinking it and move into action that's really aligned with our values? Angela, I love that you're saying that. This is so damn brilliant. I just wanted that on recording. No, I'm joking. The thing that I realized as I was figuring this out was how I hadn't made that link. And when I did, it was like a veil kind of lifted. And it was so cool to see, oh, there is some logic to this model. Right, there is some real logic and a real sense of this is how we move through this. This is how we intervene in really effective ways. So yeah, it can be super helpful. And by the way, it took me 18 months to make this link. So so if you've been thinking, oh, how do I do this? Then yeah, I'm with you. But I found this to be so helpful. Is we just move around the compass one step, and we've already got some really great resources. So yeah, Jane, trying to work out the equivalent action for the martyr, and this is so clear. Yeah. So what I'm hoping is that this is going to give you a kind of map for, you know, if you've got a client who rocks up with that critic pattern, it's like, oh, instead of being perfect, we need to move to some compassion, right? This idea of needs and emotions. How do you connect to yourself? How do you belong to yourself? That takes you out of perfectionism, out of that overworking pattern. So I wanted to talk to you today about some specific ways to do this. I call the sort of interventions for protectors experiments. And I mean that in the very purest sense of an experiment, in that we are devising with our client a way for them to do something different to see what happens. So we want them to do something different to see what happens. When we're not wanting them to do something different to get a specific outcome. Right? That's often what people, so this isn't about a goal, it's about an experiment. Right? And Hannah, I just want to come back to your question around how does the martyr link to self-acceptance? So one of the things we talked about last week is how each of these protectors, and I'll just go back to this model here, each of these four protectors are the kind of shadow state of the healthy adult self resource, right? So if I go back to the model, you'll see that the healthy adult self has these four main resources: self-belief, self-acceptance, self-worth, and self-trust. Each of those resources has the potential to kind of tip into an unhelpful state when it's overplayed, right? So self-acceptance is all about accepting ourselves and so that we can belong to ourselves and connect with others. Right, when we accept who we are, our needs and our emotions, we belong to ourselves. And that helps us to connect to others. When that's overplayed, it becomes martyrdom, right? We are so connected to other people that we prioritize their needs over our own, right? Likewise with the scapegoat, when self-worth is all about our boundaries, action and advocacy, the space we take up, and I appreciate we haven't gone into this in great detail yet, but self-worth is all about, you know, how do I take up space in the world? And that's all about self-responsibility, right? Self-worth, that's how we do those things, is we have to take action and advocate for ourselves. When that's overplayed, we get overwhelmed. It's too much responsibility, right? So we're like, I'm not going to try, it's too much. And that tips into that scapegoat feeling, right? It's a kind of collapsing response. With self-trust, you know, again, this is about how do I know what I know? How do I know what I know is right for me, right? So we're tapping into intellect and intuition, making decisions, using our discernment, taking perspective. When that feels overwhelming, we get stuck in overthinking, and so we wait, right? We kind of get into that freeze state of the bystander, where we're like, oh, I can't do anything until I know more. Yeah. And with self-belief, it's all about having a vision and a goal for our lives, you know, in whatever facet of our lives, leading ourselves towards that, encouraging ourselves to keep going, right? When that tips over, when our self-belief tips over into something that's a bit dysfunctional but unhelpful, it gets overplayed into overworking, right? So the critic is the shadow side of self-belief. Yeah. So what we're doing by making that connection with these shadow aspects of the healthy adult self is you start to see the relationship. If you have a big inner critic, a loud inner critic, it's likely that it's kind of taking over from your self-belief. Right? I just want to pause there because we've got some questions. Always interested in your questions. So Angela, I'll take yours, and then I want to come back and chat to you, Jane.
I'm wondering if you could put that model back up, because I'm just wondering about something. Sure. As it ties into the quiz. So for example, like one of my top three is designer. So here's how I'm making sense of this. I just want to see if this is accurate. So if someone takes the quiz, which I think is a great starting point, I've had people take quizzes. It's been very insightful. And then I look at this chart and I say, okay, so what's probably happening is when that designer is really activated, they're highly critical of themselves. And the whole key is to have them take some healthy, you know, experiments. And then what I would do is come to the connection, needs and emotions, belonging, like those topics, and create some experiments around that, because in order to kind of, I guess, soften or quiet the critic, then people like myself, I need to go into the self-acceptance. Is that, am I thinking
exactly
those connections right?
Exactly. That. So remember that the archetypes are kind of further delineated aspects of the critic, right? So the archetypes are these protectors further delineated into specific patterns, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting for a moment that there are no other. It's just of the folks that I've worked with over the years, of the patterns I've seen, this is what it looks like to me. And it's a great start point, because even if your client goes, I don't recognize that, you're starting the conversation. Right. Mm-hmm. But exactly what you're describing, Angela, if you've got someone with, you know, an advocate, a conductor, or a designer, it's likely that the critic is taking shape as their protector in some way. And to move out of that, we want to understand more about the specifics of that. But to move out of that, we don't want to give them some more things to do, right? Because the critic is all about overworking in some way. We want to help them to embrace other aspects of themselves so that they can move out of that pattern. And in this session, we're going to talk specifically about how to move out of these separate four patterns. Yeah. But yes, you're absolutely on it. And I appreciate it's a lot of information to take in. And I don't want you to worry about getting the model right. Okay. I want you to pay attention to your clients. This is just the reference point, a map to help you see where to go. Right. It's like let's start here and see what happens, right? As we're always doing. Jane, can I come to you?
Do you want me to ask the question?
Yeah, just ask the question. It's easier.
So I put two up there. One is about so if you're in one of the shadow selves, like the martyr, you took us through the way through that might be, for example, self-acceptance. So the way to manage the martyr or support the martyr is through self-acceptance. So what's but then now we're looking at the way forward is by moving around the wheel, so into self-worth or warrior. So what's the relationship between the way through and the way forward?
Love it Great question. So the thing to know is that there is no formula for helping a client move out of self-doubt. Right. And this isn't meant to be a formula. But what I want to show you is that when you start to see specific patterns showing up in your clients, there are specific experiments that I found, and this is continuing to be fed into by all the coaches that have gone through this program. When we use specific experiments designed to interrupt that pattern, one of the four patterns, we do that in particular ways, and that has a greater impact on the client. So rather than going with what the client wants to change, we're actually designing an experiment to help them shift the belief that's underneath the pattern. Right. So remember, there is a belief that comes with behaviors, that comes with patterns. Right. Over time, they build on each other. I've got a belief, I don't finish things. Right. I've got some behaviors where I start stuff, but then I get to a point and I just wait and I watch on the sidelines because I don't think I know enough. So, I'm thinking, well, you've got a bit of a bystander pattern there. Right. And we start to see that show up in different ways. So what we want to do is help the client to move that belief. Right. So they might say, well, I just need to take some action. I just need to get out of this. Help me take action.
Yeah.
But that isn't going to interrupt that pattern because the belief is still the same. Mm-hmm. The belief is, I don't know enough. So taking action isn't going to shift that belief, but connecting them to the values, to the vision, the bigger reasons why they're interested in this thing in the first place helps them to move out of that pattern. Can I ask, let's pause this for a second, because my idea was to give you a quick and dirty run through and then go into this in detail. So let's go into the detail and then we can come back and look at what is the confusion or the questions that you might have. Yeah. But I guess, you know, the thing to remember is two things. One, there's no formula. Right? This is just weighs in. And the second thing is the where the client's at is more important than any model. Right? So it's designed as a reference point to help you figure some of this out. And to know, like, well, how do I intervene with someone who has a really loud inner critic, who has a really loud bystander? Hmm. Yeah.
So in that sense, are you saying you could pick either way forward, depending on the client and where they are and what you feel might resonate best with that, whether it's moving into self-worth or whether it's spending time with self-acceptance.
Absolutely.
In the example I gave.
Absolutely. Yeah. And your discretion as a coach is more important than any model. Right. So I don't want you to, but in any of this work, I don't want you to replace your own judgment with mine. But what I do want you to do is go, oh, this helps me make better choices, right? This helps me make more informed choices. Okay. Let's go through these in detail. Let's remind ourselves of the critic. It's all about being perfect. Perfect comes in different flavors. It could be, I've got to be the perfect student. Could be, I've got to be the one who's always put together, or my branding has to look perfect before I can do anything. It's driven by the belief I'm not good enough, right? Unless it's good enough, I will be measured on everything I do, I say, all of that, right? So the behaviors we see are driven by overworking. This is that constant need to keep proving myself, right? And the fear underneath it all is about losing control, being criticized by others, feeling too much. Okay. So we went into this in more detail in the last session. So the thing to know about the critic is that we want to experiment with something other than this false sense of safety, right? The false sense of safety that the critic has created is you have to do more. You have to keep proving yourself. The truth is you can't do enough for that critic to feel safe. That's not where safety comes from. Safety comes from no matter what I do or don't do, I'm okay. I've got me, right? So what we want to do is experiment with compassion and imperfection, right? Rather than setting the bar so high that we can't ever reach it, we want to encourage our clients to experiment with compassion and imperfection. If they bring that healthy adult self resource up, it gives that protector less work to do. Because then it doesn't matter what you're doing or not doing, you're okay with you. See what I mean by it's not about matching the energy of what created the protector. It's about coming at it in a different way. And what you'll notice is that compassion, that imperfection, that's where, you know, we start to look at self-acceptance. You know, can I accept that I'm imperfect? Can I offer myself compassion no matter how I'm feeling about this thing that I have to do? Yeah. So some ideas for experiments, right? Where are you overworking and what is this protecting you from? Right, so I'm going to give you some real concrete things that you can do with clients. The first option for all of these protectors is to play with gathering some data, right? It's the least risk experiment that a client can do. Audit your protector, right? Notice, where are you overworking? Why are you doing that? What's it protecting you from? Client may know. They may not. So it's a great thing to do in between a couple of sessions. Like, get a sense of that. What do you keep proving yourself around? What's that about? And what do you imagine that's protecting you from? Practice speaking to yourself with compassion 100% of the time. So remember, the critic protector is quite bullying. It's quite judgy. There's a lot of that kind of energy. It's very critical, right? It does what it says on the tin. So inviting your client to spend 24 hours, 48 hours, the next 2 weeks, speaking to themselves with compassion 100% of the time is a great experiment. No one even needs to know that they're doing it, right? But get them to notice what comes up. They're going to do this imperfectly. So it's like, well, whenever you find yourself being, you know, talking shit to yourself, you just apologize and you say, oh, I'm sorry. And I'm going to start again. Because you're teaching them how to do this imperfectly, right? And it's like, let it be awkward, let it seem cheesy, and let them hate it. But still, it's like nothing bad can happen from this, right? I can't tell you how many people have done this experiment and done it with a shit ton of resistance. It's like, do it with some snark then. That's okay. I'm cool with that, right? Do it as you, because often there is a belief with the critic. If I don't use critical language and bullying language to keep myself going, I will lose my edge. I'll end up doing nothing. So you want to notice, is that actually true? A lot of men that I've coached with, particularly men in leadership positions, have found this to be kind of the doorway in to actually looking at what else might be happening, if they can embrace it. And I now, whenever I meet men who are quite bullying, which has always been a bit of a entanglement issue for me, I'm like, oh honey, you must be speaking to yourself like that the whole time. That must be a hard place to live, you know. So if this is you, if you have a dominant critic, I highly recommend this as a first experiment. Just take the next 72 hours, 3 days, and speak to yourself with compassion 100% of the time, and just see what comes up for you. What beliefs, what self-talk, what that leads to. It's going to make for a really rich session, either in your practice pod or with your supervisor or your coach or whoever you want to share this with, right? Anyone got any resistance to trying that? All you ones with critic protectors? Everyone going, oh yeah, I might do that. Yeah. Yeah, Tina.
Well, I was just thinking about something when I try to help my clients with this, there's this sometimes really sad but embedded belief about that the truth is they're bad. You know, like, so they'll say, like, anytime I had somebody say to me last week, and I'm trying to think of his wording, but he has it embedded, if it's true that it's, yeah, if someone says it and someone gives them feedback, then it absolutely means that it's true, even if it's negative. And it just reminds me, because then it's really tricky for them to, you know, that's why affirmations don't work, because their self-belief is like, that's crap. I'm not doing that. That's not true. You know, so.
And this is the thing, right? This is a different thing from an affirmation. This is actually about offering yourself compassion. Compassion is not coddling.
Right.
Right. So I always say, you know, have you got a pet? Have you got a kid? How would you speak to them? That's the model for how to speak to yourself with some compassion.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, you know, if say you've been giving your child a treat after school for the last few months, and then you read something about how that particular treat has got something actually really dodgy in it and you're like, oh God, I don't want to give them to it anymore. What's going to happen is when you say you can't have that treat today, we're going to have something else, they're going to kick off, right? So it's like, honey, I know you want this treat, but it's just not good for you. And I love you enough to not give it to you. And we're going to try something else. Let's see what options we've got. Right. So like, this is the voice you can use when you're talking to yourself. Right. Like, honey, I can totally see why you'd be pissed off about that. I know you don't feel like doing this hard thing today. It's okay. You're allowed to feel like that. Right. It's validation. It's kindness. It's like, you don't have to pretend that you don't feel the thing you feel, but it's more, there isn't anything wrong with you because of that. The thing that speaking to yourself with compassion 100% of the time does for your self-esteem is that over time it creates this kind of cushion effect so that when someone does criticize you, you're a bit like, it's got something to bounce off rather than going straight through into you. And as you say, Tina, well, that must be true about me, right? Yeah. So it can be a really beautiful experiment for people to play with. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, Hannah.
Hello. I just had a question about, I'm just thinking of a person, but if it feels like they are like this sort of critical, like sort of perfectionist, nothing's quite good enough, but they're not in an overdoing pattern. Like, I think this experiment would still work, the compassionate voice, but I'm just curious about, yeah, what you think about that. Because say, for example, they don't want to share something because they're like, they've done it, they've put a lot of work into it, they're like, it's still not good enough. And like, nothing will ever really be good enough. So they're kind of, in a way, underdoing it and like not sharing or creating stuff because it will never live up to right. the standards in their head.
Yeah. Well, they're still working really hard just at not sharing the thing.
Yeah.
Right. So if you've got business owners, and this is a classic pattern for a business owner, is the connection between the critic and the bystander. That's a really common pattern. So work hard, work hard, work hard, work hard, wait. It's not ready. I don't know enough. It's not good enough. Right. That kind of pattern. So some of you may recognize that pattern in yourselves, right? So the idea here is pay attention. What are you holding back from and why, right? What is it that they want to be doing that they're not? So, it comes down to the individual client, but what is the story they are telling themselves about this? It's going to be based on a perceived risk. Right? Why isn't it good enough? Because not everyone will love it. And I don't know who I'll be if that happens. What if I'm disappointed with the outcome? Right? So I'm protecting myself from all of that. So talking to yourself with a compassionate voice, it's okay if you're disappointed. You worked so hard on this. Right? It's okay. Disappointment feels completely understandable right now. And we'll never know. What's the best thing that could happen? We will never know. We don't know what reality we're dealing with because we're stuck in waiting until it's perfect, right? So that compassion is still relevant, right? But you may find there's a better experiment for that particular client, right? So just to kind of pick up on that, Hannah, being consciously imperfect, right? So For clients who have that real kind of everything's got to be all tied up, find a way to take some risks with imperfection, right? Things like if the whole house has to be tidy the whole time, I don't really know anyone like that, but some clients are like that, right? It's like, we'll just leave the dishes out overnight, see what happens. Right? Is it really terrible that happens? If you always have to be put together, just experiment with not wearing makeup a couple of days a week and see what happens, right? It's all of these ways of consciously introducing imperfection. Another great one is if you have kids where they're at a sort of decision-making age, sort of usually about 5 or 6 onwards, let them organize a weekend. They get to decide what you eat, what you do. It's going to be chaos. You're not going to be in control. You're going to hate it. But your kids will love it and it will be fun, right? Because it's imperfect. And they're going to want to eat pizza 3 times a day. And you're going to be like, what is even happening? But the idea is that it is fun, that you do get to practice being imperfect, right? And you and your kids will see you relax for a little bit. play on purpose, right? Just allow yourself to be silly. Have fun. Right, these are things you can do with a kind of, you know, sense of humor, depending on the client. Practice one boundary around overwork, right? So what, and this is just to pick up your point, Hannah, get specific with a client. Allow yourself to be creative and brainstorm some ideas together, right? So one experiment I used to use a lot with overworking people in corporate world was what time do you turn your phone off at night? As a child of the BlackBerry generation, where I used to have a constant flicking red light going off all night and terrible sleep. You know, what time do you turn your phone off? Most people will say it's never off if they have this. Because what if I miss something? What if someone sees me as incompetent, dropping the ball, et cetera, et cetera? So it's like, okay, let's experiment with turning the phone off. What's a reasonable time to turn the phone off? And they're going to say something ridiculous like midnight. And so it's like, okay, let's try that for a week and then bring it back until it's actually at the time that you are stopping work. Right. And the idea here is that you get to have some compassion for yourself as a human being. Right. You have, remember, self-acceptance. You have needs, you have emotions. You don't need to be constantly on. So all of these experiments are around that sense of, can I just accept how I feel and what I need? And it is likely to be, put up a bit of a tension between my, you know, what I feel and what I need is going to be in tension with overworking, likely. So we're doing something different, right? There is going to be a bit of resistance around this. But the idea is you already know what happens if you carry on doing what you're doing, right? The experiment is to see if you can create some richer, deeper safety through trying something new, just to see what happens. Yeah. So this is a very imperfect list and incomplete list of potential experiments to play with that critic pattern, right? But you can see where I'm going here, right? Compassion and perfection, that's going to help you get into, I'm a human being, I can't, you know, I'm not a robot, I've got a way to move through this. Okay, the martyr. This is the second kind of over-functioning protective pattern. It's all about being needed, right? So it's the flip side of self-acceptance is, you know, I don't matter as much as you do. Right, so it's always focused on other people's needs. And so you'll see a client who's overgiving, has a lack of boundaries, in self-sacrifice the whole time. And they're trying to manage this fear of being abandoned, being disliked, creating conflict, right? It's why people don't want to say, this is actually, to say no, or this is actually what I want to do, because that will risk conflict. So I'll just go along with whatever you say. So to play with this, to entertain the idea that this is a pattern, it's not who the person is, and that they have options for how they can experiment, we want to, you know, help that martyr know they cannot give enough to feel safe. Right? There is no limit to how much they can give for them to feel safe, because that's not where safety comes from. Right, for the martyr, it's all about acknowledging emotions, prioritizing needs, and that means moving into self-worth. Self-worth is all about advocacy and action, right? Not that kind of like, oh, whatever you want, it's okay, I'll just go along, or I'll do whatever you need. It's actually about acknowledging that you've got your own emotions and needs, and you need to advocate for them, right? So we're playing with experiments around this, like just notice it, auditing this, right? Auditing how that martyr pattern is showing up. Where are you dismissing your emotions or sacrificing your needs? And what is this protecting you from? Right? That's going to give you some great ideas for what you, what you want to actually put a boundary around, right? How you want to respond differently. So we need to kind of know what we're playing with. So even, and this is particularly true for people with a martyr pattern, is the first thing they want to do, or the last thing they want to do rather, is say no, put a boundary in place. I mean, that just feels like death, right? Because that's inviting the things that they're most afraid of, abandonment and conflict, being disliked. So low risk experiments is just to find out how this is showing up. Find out what this looks like. Right? Where are they dismissing their emotions or sacrificing their needs, and what is that protecting them from? And starting to experiment with this, claiming some time and space just for you, right? This self-worth is all about the space we take up in the world. So it's amazing to me what can happen when your client decides, oh, actually, if I had 20 minutes in the morning just to myself or I wasn't disturbed, that would make such a difference to my day. That would set me up. I could do some stretching, do some journaling, do some meditation, whatever that looks like. Everyone's always convinced that all they need is a morning routine and life will be amazing. So this is a way to do that, right? Claim some regular time and space just for you and see what happens, right? Because actually, unless the person is living alone, and even then, they will probably need to negotiate this with someone else. And it's highly likely that that boundary is going to be pushed on by those people while they're getting used to this new routine. Right. And so that's going to require some advocacy. But the idea is, can you see that you can make a different choice? Right. That's the purpose of this experiment. What if you limited the time you spend doing things you hate? Right. I've worked with a number of when I've coached whole teams, gone into organizations, and people are either overgiving or they're kind of opting out of the team. They don't even want to be involved. There's these two kind of patterns that show up. So actually, this is a really great experiment to play with as a team. Let's all choose one task that the team's responsible for that you hate doing, and we divvy them out. So what, everyone has at least one thing that they don't like doing that they don't have to do, and they are then bonded to the rest of the team to get done. Right, so you start to see, oh, I don't have to do everything. I can ask for help. I can say I don't want to do something. What do you need right now? Practice some honesty with yourself. Again, this is a great one for people with that martyred pattern. Can you just be honest with what you need right now? You don't have to tell anyone else that you don't want to do it or that you need something, but be honest with yourself. You're starting to build that sense of a relationship with your healthy adult. And what's one thing you could do differently in one relationship? It could be a great experiment. For example, if you maybe have a team member or a friend or a loved one who always does something that really grates on you that you wish you had the courage to say something about. Right? What's one thing you could do differently in that relationship? And the thing is that all we're doing is entertaining the idea that you have different choices. You're not locked into these patterns. This isn't who you are. It's not a blood type, right? It's an option. It's just something we've repeated over time. Just want to pause there and see how that is all kind of landing for you as we go. Notice what kind of patterns your clients might have and how you might work with them quite specifically around this stuff. Yeah, Tina.
The thing that's my brain's just really distracted right now is I'm thinking of a specific client who presents pretty much all four. And so I was just thinking about how I guess you really need to troubleshoot which one is bothering them the most or which one they want to work on. Because for her, she's a critic at her for her work performance, martyr for her extended family and her kids. She's a scapegoat for her health. And then the bystander where it comes to authority figures. Yeah. So I've seen all of them, you know, affect her in different ways. So I guess I was thinking, yeah, you'd have to really kind of troubleshoot which one is giving you the most pain that you want to look to.
You could do it that way. You could also go, what do you feel like is the easiest one to fix?
Oh, I like that. Yeah. I like that.
Right?
Like, yeah.
Because often our clients will be like, right, there's this terrible thing that's happening that I need to solve first. And often that's the thing we solve last.
Right. Because it's right? Huge.
Yeah. So you can flip it. You can say, what do you feel like? Actually, there's just some tweaks that I need to make here.
Yeah.
Right.
Then they'd feel successful. I like that.
Yeah. And it's easier to build on. And it, you raise a really great point, Tina, because what I have found is that people only need a couple of experiments to go, oh, I've had this idea of what was going to happen. And it totally didn't work out that way. So now I'm curious to know what might happen if I try something else. Right? Because our brains are always going to try and offer us the most efficient thing to think. That's usually going to be a neural pathway that we've thought over and over and over again. But it's not actually based on reality. It's based on our perception of a risk that may or may not exist. But even if the risk occurs, right? So, and I just want to give this example. Say your client decides, okay, I'm going to, I've got a kind of weight approach, overthink approach when it comes to authority figures. What I'm actually going to do is connect to a value, and a value for me is about maybe justice. So I'm going to speak truth to power. I'm going to actually say something that I think isn't right about something that's going on in the organization. And they go through that process with you, and they figure out what they want to say, and then they go and do this incredibly brave thing. And then there's an outcome of something. Right? Maybe the person agrees with them and says, leave it with me, I'll act on it, and then they never do, or they see that behavior again and again, or what we can't control that outcome, right? So even if they are told, this is none of your business, it's beyond your pay grade, and I'll deal with it, right? Even if they get a kind of criticizing response, the fact that she has gone through this process, she now knows that even when she's kind of shaken in her boots, she can do this, right? Right. So the outcome is way less important than the process, than right. The act of challenging the validity of this belief, right? And that's the important thing about, for our clients, is we're just trying something out to see what might happen, right? And it's also why, you know, I kind of recommend that you don't start with the biggest thing, right? Because actually we can't control the outcome. And sometimes if the outcome carries a lot of risk with it, that can be pretty, you know, that can almost reinforce this pattern. So we always want to stay with these low risk experiments, at least to start with, just yes. To see, right? We're just seeing what might happen.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. Anyone else want to say anything so far before we move on to the other two? Okay, so the scapegoat. Don't try is the whole aim of the scapegoat, right? Because it's so much harder for me. I'm overwhelmed. This is what I call the adulting protective pattern, right? It's too complex, it's too hard, it's better to not try. So just quit, right? It's all about responsibility, consistency, keeping promises. That feels overwhelming, so it's easier to just stay not trying, to either quit or to just stay in chaos and feeling helpless. If like Tina, you mentioned your client has a lot, has kind of like all of the protective patterns, this is often the one I would start with. Because one or two kind of expansions of our self-concept in this protective pattern is going to pave the way for others. Not necessarily a rule. Remember, there's no formula. But I think sometimes this can be the one, it's like an easy one. Sometimes it's like, oh my God, my whole wardrobe is just the cupboard of doom. And it can literally be, okay, this weekend, it's wardrobe clearing out time. And there's some, like, usually, you know, that real kind of low hanging fruit of, I've just done one great thing. Okay, right. I'm sorted with that. You know, even a drawer can sometimes help. So yeah. And you know, I would also say, I think a part of me really poo-pooed those kinds of like easy life coachy type approaches to this kind of stuff. But, you know, clients will say, oh my God, my pantry is organized. I can't tell you how much more on top of my life I feel. Right, let's go sort out my pay rise. So for me, it's like, I'm just going to honor the client, right, wherever they're at. So if getting the pay rise is traced directly back to the gateway drug of sorting out your wardrobe, I'm there for it, right? I'm there for it. Okay, so working with the scapegoat, the person can't quit enough for the scapegoat to feel safe, right? You can't, that's not where safety comes from, right? So instead, we gotta move into keeping promises and taking responsibility, right? And we do that through that lens of self-trust. I can trust myself to do this, okay? So again, you start with the kind of auditing experiment, like just gather some data. Where are you overwhelmed? And what is this protecting you from? Right? Keep a promise to yourself. What's a promise you want to make? And keep it. Keep it for 30 days. Keep it for 2 weeks in between our sessions or whatever feels good to you or the client. Just keep one promise to yourself. Notice all the excuses, all the reasoning, all the justification you give to yourself to break that promise. Be in that discomfort and see if you can still keep it. Do it imperfectly, right? Maybe there's a couple of days where you don't do it. But notice how you can always come back from that. Right? Keep a promise to yourself. It's a fantastic way to build self-trust. Organize or complete one thing today. Yeah. Again, it's just a way of going, oh, okay, I can do one thing. Maybe I can't do all the things, but I can do one thing. Where does your overwhelm make complete sense? Who can help? Right, and I say this because overwhelm is part of our cultural story, right? Particularly for humans who identify as women. Because we're given 3 full-time jobs if we've got kids. You know, the just the stats on things like emotional labor and, you know, all of that jazz, all the information you have to keep in your head at one time. Who needs sports gear and, you know, whose birthday in the kid number 2's class is coming up and just all of that. You know, when you're running out of loo roll and what load of washing needs to be done. All of that information is in your head. So even if job isn't overwhelming you, the fact that you're taking that all on is. So where does your overwhelm make complete sense? This is a great way of really allowing your client to validate their own response to the world. And it can be incredibly helpful when it's like, it's okay to ask for help. You don't have to take all of this on your own. Who can you ask for help? What would that look like? Right? And so taking responsibility can sometimes mean, I can't do this. I can't do all of this. Right? It's all about that advocacy work. Yeah. So these are ideas for experiments with that scapegoat pattern. It's all about, you know, give yourself the joyous experience of completion, of knowing that you are capable of something, even if it's that, even and because that is a small doable thing. Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah, and I'm bow to the experience and expertise in the room around neurodivergence and the feeling of overwhelm. Right. And so if you're working with clients where they reveal that to you, then, you know, as Jane said, it's like our world is very unsupportive of anything that goes beyond what's normal. Oh. And I think we can all agree, we don't want to, you know, we want to be in the client's corner. Right. So we want them to feel like, okay, this makes total sense. This may be a bit trickier. So let's figure this out. This is where your own creativity comes to the fore. We get to play with this with people. I once had a client who worked for a social justice advocacy group in her spare time, and she wanted to write a book. And so one of the things that the promise that she kept to herself was, she put together a doable plan for writing her book, and the promise she made to herself was every time she didn't participate in her plan or complete her plan, she would donate $1 or $10 to Donald Trump's campaign, which was so at odds with her own values, right? And it was fun, right? It was meant to be fun, and she absolutely took it in that spirit. She came up with it. The book was written. But yeah, it's kind of fun, right, to play with these ideas of how do we keep ourselves in that place of keeping a promise. You know, sometimes we need a little link up to our values around this stuff. Angela, do you want to talk more about this? The question is brilliant. How do you adjust things for folks who struggle with consistency or even remembering what their experiment is every day in the case of neurodivergent brains? How would you do that?
Well, that's what I'm personally struggling with, because I was just diagnosed this year. And so recognizing things like this, like the whole donate to Donald Trump campaign, I'm like, oh my gosh, I would be writing my book every day. That's what I tell myself. And then I guarantee you there will be a day that I completely forgot that I had that goal. And I'd be like, there's no way in hell I'm donating to your, like, whatever the consequence is. I'm like, I'm not doing that. And so those experiments have never worked for me. And so, sometimes I think, especially with like the scapegoat where they're not doing something, and it's like, well, what of the million ideas do I take action on right now? And then the critic comes in like, but it's not going to be perfect anyway. And so then it just becomes this loop. And so I really sometimes struggle with like, how much of this is approaching it through the lens of the protective beliefs? And then also how much of this is like for an ADHD brain of like, okay, there's a lack of dopamine here. So how can we attend to that? And it's a both and, it's not an either or. And so maybe it's just part of my not confusion, but just kind of like, I'm not really sure how to make sense of some of these tools, because I'm figuring some things out myself as a neurodivergent person. So that was a lot of words, but I'll pause.
It was great. And it's right on the hour. So if you go back and listen to this, what I think you're going to find is you've answered your own question with some brilliant ideas, okay? Which often happens. So one of the things you said was, well, if I knew I had to donate to Donald Trump, I would be writing my book, but actually I would never do that, right? So notice you're quitting on the experiment. So what would happen if you did write that check or send that bank transfer to his campaign? What might that do in terms of shifting your perspective, right?
Are you asking me like what that might do? Or
but, well, it's a we don't know, right? Because it's an experiment. But what usually happens is you don't kind of forget the feeling of resentment of that, right? Other things like, a dopamine, exactly what Tina's saying, a dopamine boost as a way to keep a promise to yourself might be easier than a task, right? So it may be that the experiment is, how do I boost up my dopamine before I get on with my doing work of the day? Mm-hmm. What does that look like? How's that a way of, you know, advocating for myself so I just have more capacity? Mm-hmm. Maybe I need to put some structures in place, like writing myself a list the night before of the two or three things I really want to complete tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So it's like we can get super practical with folks here. Mm-hmm. And I think exactly what you talked about as well, like it's a both and with the protective beliefs. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's going to give us a clue around what's underneath some of this stuff. Right. So the catch-all for the scapegoat is it's so much harder for me. Right. And so what is the really specific protective belief that may be showing up for your clients around that? And then, you know, the experiment can be related to whatever the more helpful belief is they come up with. Right. So when we're coaching with clients, we probably wouldn't go through all four, you know, we wouldn't do this kind of session, right? We'd just be keeping this in mind. Oh, as we're going through looking at protective beliefs, as we're, you know, getting to know this human being, we're starting to see how they keep themselves safe, how they hold themselves back. And so when you're looking at those doable actions to bring this more helpful belief into being, you can start to see, oh, how are these, you know, how are these experiments going to support that? Right? How is this going to kind of alleviate some of that protective pattern? So yeah, anything that you can do to support your client making suggestions is going to help. And if you have those, you know, you have a lot of subject matter expertise, it's growing. I appreciate, you know, you're living with this yourself. So it may be that you're kind of experimenting with yourself first to see what helps you so that you can make those suggestions to clients, you know, as a way forward, right? And this is, I think this is where this model can be applied to any kind of coaching, right? Whoever your client group are, the idea here is that you can get super creative and specific to your specific clients, your particular client group, using this as a kind of reference point in the background, right? So, you know, what's being overplayed, right? Are they overgiving, overworking? Are they overwhelmed or overthinking? What is it that in their healthy adult self is being overplayed, and what is the best way through? Yeah. And Adrian, I think you're speaking to this as well, like what is that subject matter expertise that can help you, and how does that look? Often our clients don't need more information, they need help, they need support to figure out why they're not doing the thing and what they could do instead, and that's what this is all about. Yeah, cool. Does that feel kind of okay for you, Angela, just for us to move to the next one? Yeah? Yeah. You're okay?
Yeah.
Great. You're so welcome. Okay, so let's have a little look at the bystander, right? And remember, the bystander is all about waiting. Stand on the sidelines and wait. Because I don't have enough information to take action. I don't know enough. So I'm overthinking or I'm stuck in research, but I generally feel unable to act, right? Because I don't want to make the wrong choice. I don't want to look silly, and I don't want to fail, right? They're the kind of fears that are underneath all of that, yeah? So the thing to remember about the bystander is you can't wait long enough to feel safe, right? The only thing that happens is time passes. Safety doesn't come from waiting. Safety comes from no matter what happens, I've got my own back. Right? So we want to experiment with making decisions and taking values-led action. Right, so the values part of this is connecting to the bigger why, the bigger picture of self-belief. Yeah. So we're really kind of leaning into that. Why do anything? Why do anything? There is a reason why you are wanting to do this thing, this particular thing. That's, in my opinion, connected to your unique expression of the universe in human form. You have a set of values. You have characteristics and skills and experience and knowledge and personality traits, and they all make up you, and only you can do this thing in the way you're going to do it. So if you're waiting, we want you to feel safe to not wait so that you can connect to that expression of the universe in human form. So you can feel the satisfaction of that. Right? You can connect to your own leadership, your own values, and the vision you have for your life. Yeah. So where are you waiting before taking the next step, and what is this protecting you from? Again, just that auditing experiment is a great thing. Some people will know. Some people won't. They'll just have this general feeling of just feel like my life's on hold. Feel like I should be in a different place. Right? So it's like, okay, well, let's gather some data around that. Let's see what is actually going on here. Where do you feel like you're holding back? You're just waiting. What are you waiting for? Right? Often people are waiting for a sign. How will they know? Usually it's, oh no, it's not that, I want a signy sign, right? So it's all about waiting. Sometimes they're waiting for permission. I can't tell you the amount of women I've worked with who are sadly waiting for their parents to pass on so they can do what they want to do in their lives, right? Don't wait. They'll be okay. So we got to help our people to take action, right? Pay attention to your future fantasies and idealized worlds, right? Often with the bystander, there is this kind of fantasy, magical thinking that happens. You know, once I do this though, like when I do this, I'll be unstoppable. Everything will be great, right? When I do this thing, when I stop waiting, my life will change in this way, right? And so that in itself is a perception, right? We don't know that that's true. It's an assumption. It's an idealized assumption, because in my experience, often the things we wait for actually end up being a bit anticlimactic. But what's one thing you can do to bridge the gap? Let's, you know, if we're going to fail, let's fail fast, right? Let's figure it out. What's one thing you can do to bridge the gap into that future that you're looking for? Play with some shared accountability, right? How can you work with someone else so that you're both taking action and supporting each other? That can sometimes be quite fun. So with a client, it might be like, can you share that you're waiting with someone else? Especially if people feel like, if I'm accountable to someone else, I'll probably do it. All right, then that can be fun. For lots of people, that doesn't work, but for a lot of people, it does. So again, it's about the specifics of the client, yeah. And connecting to that bigger picture, your values, your why. What is, why do anything, right? What is this about? I often find that business owners, coaches, will have a protective pattern when it comes to taking action in their business that is bystander critic connected, right? So it's like, it's not perfect, and therefore I'm waiting, right? So why are you doing the work you're doing? It's often about something that's much bigger than this next step that you are holding back from. Right, so getting someone to connect to that, take the next doable step. Yeah. And another thing to do is to find ways to be embodied and in the moment, right? It's a way of diluting that feeling of overthinking. Right. So just, you know, if for someone who's like, I cannot take action on this thing, then it's like, okay, what I want you to do is to play with getting embodied each day. Play with something that you can't do perfectly, that you can maybe look a bit foolish at, or feel like you're not being super successful at it, right? Remember, the big fear around the bystander is failing and looking foolish. So to be embodied, to dance, to do yoga, especially if it's like, oh, I'm not very good at that kind of thing, like playing with that just to see what it's like to challenge yourself in a new way, right? And it's a way of helping yourself feel safe that isn't about overthinking. I can, you know, do a yoga move and it go horribly wrong and I look silly and it's okay. Oh, I love that, Adrienne. In your experience, body doubling is a great strategy for ADHD is when it comes to shared accountability. So not checking in after the fact, but literally sitting next to someone while you each do the things you want to do. Perfect. Yep. Exactly that. Georgina, who was in one of the first classes of SBCA, ADHD runs a writer's group and they do exactly that. And she said it's amazing to just be all in the room together. And they have, you know, they use the Pomodoro technique and, you know, color-coded charts. And she's got it up the wazoo, right? But she's like, oh, all of these are just fantastic tools for writers of a particular flavor, right? Which is writers with ADHD. You know, again, it comes down to the creativity of you as a coach to offer these things, right? Offer this as a way of doing that. And it can be incredibly liberating for a client who's like, oh, maybe this isn't who I am. Maybe I just haven't found a way that supports me to expand and try something new. Okay, I just want to pause there and just check in with everyone around how that is all feeling. I know that's a lot of information. It's probably one of the most information-heavy sessions. Any like questions, thoughts, what's bubbling up for you as you take all that in? Is it making sense, that idea of experimenting, trying new things, challenging these protective beliefs through action, right? That what we're doing is creating some new energy around this thing that is holding the person back so that they can try a new thing, see what happens, right? Bringing in that healthy adult self, right? Every time you use that creativity and you the client tries something new, they are accessing the healthy adult self, the part of them that is much bigger and more resourced than the protector. So what I recommend in terms of this is to choose an experiment that you kind of want to play with, and you may want to get some coaching around this in your pods if you kind of want some help to come up with something, or you know, you just want to get some input, that can be super great. But the idea is that you actually kind of take on an experiment to play with yourself that will help your protective patterns, and you share that with your pod so that you can kind of do this auditing experiment at least as well as what you're actually trying. So you're really getting a sense of what is it like before, during and after your experiment, whatever you choose to take on, right? And the idea is that you're starting to get a sense of, oh, what happens when I do this once? Or, you know, if it's something that you're doing over a period of time, what happens on the fifth or the seventh time? What happens when you do it imperfectly? Right? Because willpower won't be sustained over that period of time. So, you know, can you plan for, okay, what am I going to do or say to myself when I start to do this imperfectly? What if I miss a day or three? How will I bring myself back on track? And what will I ask for from my pod to play with? What else could happen? And what's it like to coach your pod mates around this? You know, what does that feel like? How's that sounding? I think the thing to really remember around experiments is that it's not about the outcome. It's really about, let's try something new and let's see what happens. Right? The outcome will often come as a byproduct anyway, but it's more about, you know, really having that sort of validation that it's okay for you to try something new, you know, that it's safe to do that. You don't have to resort to these old patterns of protective beliefs and behaviours. You can try something new. And as I said, what I have found time and time and time again is that it only takes a couple of times, a couple of experiments where the client has a bit of a breakthrough about what's possible, where they feel more and more brave around this stuff and more willing to try stuff out, more okay with, whatever happens, I've got my own back, right? And I think that for me is how we, if it's possible to overcome self-doubt, I'm not convinced it is, but how we can reduce the grip that it has on us, on our clients, is that we are more and more led by a healthy adult self. So we're willing to experiment, to try new things out. We're willing to feel whatever happens as a result, right? I'm willing to be with disappointment, with some failure, you know, with some conflict, complexity, because I kind of know whatever happens, I've got me. That's where true safety, I think, comes from. And then our protectors have just got way less shit to do. It's like, I can relax, right? So they have the same response to us eating Doritos on the sofa as being super visible on social media or doing a brave thing in some arena of our lives that felt, you know, a little bit edgy before. We expand our comfort zone so that it's easier to show up to our lives. So I know that was a lot of info. This is probably one of the most info-heavy calls we'll have. But what I'm hoping is that you're starting to see, we're putting this stuff together, you know, building on some good building blocks around, you know, looking at the root causes, the protective stories that happen and how we can intervene in those, and then, you know, really working with the protector. So we're really kind of, you know, able to understand and intervene in when our self-doubt is showing up. Our next module is around us as coaches and our self-doubt and how that shows up. And we're sort of building on these past tools. And then we start to move into the second half of the program, which is all about, you know, how do we build self-belief and, you know, the kind of expanded model of the healthy adult self. How do we build those resources and tools? Yeah, Tina.
Sorry, I just have a question. When you work with your clients, to what level do you educate them? Because this is a lot for us to wrap around. And I imagine you probably have like a client that'll get really interested and ask questions. I just wondered, like, because I could see a lot of coaching time being taken up both just the vocabulary, you know, so that's what I was curious about.
It's a great question. It's very much depends on the client. I would say 80% of my clients couldn't give a toss, right? It's like, don't care really. It's just like, I trust that this is relatively, you know, evidence-based. It seems to be working. I'm good. I don't need to know the whole thing, right? 20% are like, oh, So I've got this kind of pattern and it's called that, and I can see when it's coming up here and all of that, and they get really nerding out on it.
Right.
And I would always say to a client, I'm more interested in getting the outcomes from the coaching than you knowing more about the coaching, right? So it's more about the content of your experience than the process behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. Some clients are just, they're just really, you know, excited about this. And I've had a couple of clients who have gone on to train as coaches because they just loved the work. And that's makes total sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Cool. Jane.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's been super helpful and interesting. On a personal level, I think I've shifted my opinion of what I think my protector's face looks like. I always thought it was the critic, and now I'm going, it's the martyr. I mean, obviously there are different things in there, but so it's taken me a few days to kind of come to terms with that and really reflect on that and have some self-acceptance around that as well. So that's been fascinating. But also I work in the caring and creative sector. So I'm kind of also going, the martyr, that it's a lot of people in the caring professions. It's like a perfect portrait. And many of the issues I see with the people that I work with really fit this pattern. And, you know, it's not all, but definitely there's also a tendency, I think, with the creatives I work with, many of whom are neurodivergent, who struggle with some of the issues around the scapegoat. So it's really, yeah, it's been really useful. And I love, sorry, one more thing. I love that some of the experiments are so tiny, so tiny. And I particularly love, so for example, what do you need right now? You don't even have to act on that. You just have to take a minute to even register it.
Yeah.
And even just the act of registering it is enough to change everything without feeling you have to act.
Yeah.
So I love that. Great. Thank you.
I'm so glad that helps. And, you know, I think you raised such an interesting point around our own protective patterns and kind of what we identify with. And I know for myself, my critic used to be, it would show up as overworking. I never really had like the critical voice, but my overworking tendencies used to be really full on. And now that I've really interrupted that, I can see, oh, it's like a little whack-a-mole, right? And my little martyr is popping up going, okay, now that you don't have so much to do in your business, work, you know, I can see that tendency is showing up in different places. So all to say, I think our protective patterns do evolve. Sometimes we just maybe miss them or mislabel them and we get more clarity and that's helpful. And sometimes they're context specific and sometimes they just evolve over time. And I think it's really, I sort of hold all of this quite loosely. Like, you know, I believe that we as humans evolve over time and experiences and relationships change us. And so that makes complete sense to me. That feels really coherent to me. But yeah, yeah. And I completely agree. The whole, like some professions just have that kind of tendency to a particular protective pattern.
But not just in individuals, but in organization structures and systems. Yes. So that, you know, that's a big question for me is you can work with the individuals, but how do you then impact and affect, how do you loosen up those wider systems?
Well, and the first thing is everyone in that system has to agree that it's a problem or that pattern exists. In my experience, when you're working with organizations, the team has to agree, oh, this is a thing we do. So then we're going to experiment together with trying something new. It can be a really powerful team bonding day that doesn't involve, you know, playing a game, but is actually about, you know, really getting a bit vulnerable with our people and recognizing that, you know, we all have these needs and emotions and we're all human and these patterns will be playing out and we'll be getting entangled with each other. But yeah, absolutely. Culturally, organizationally, and families, you know, there are these patterns that play out. Yeah. What's expected of us? Yeah. Cool. All right, loves. I will see you same time next week. Yeah. Okay. Take care of yourselves. Just know that Scott's study group is on Thursday if you want to attend. All right, loves. Take care. I'll see you.
Thanks.
Bye. Thank you.